Welcome to Real World Theology, episode 73. On this episode of the podcast, we are talking about It Follows. It Follows is one of the best horror movies that we've seen this year or in the past couple years, or at least it ranks in, you know, the top few. To help me talk about it, break it down, and explore why this horror film, which is probably uncommon for most Christians to look at, is worth talking about, is Blaine Grimes from Real Thinking, and he does a lot of stuff here with Real World Theology, and our very own Josh Crabb, superstar of Real World Theology. With those guys, we have an excellent conversation. And in general, make sure you're checking out our website, realworldtheology.com, where we have new reviews, top five lists, streaming recommendations, podcasts, everything like that. We have something coming out daily. Check us out on Facebook at facebook.com/realworldtheology. Our Twitter handle is @realworldtheo. Subscribe to the podcast, which you can look for new episodes on the 1st, 10th, and 20th of the month. You can get us on Feedburner, Stitcher, iTunes. Rate and review the show, please, please, please. It helps us get out there. More people will find us. More people will join the conversation. And we'll just have a much better time talking about things. If we get more voices, more opinions, we really, really, really appreciate all you guys who are giving us feedback on the site, on Facebook, starting conversations with us on Twitter, either individually or with the show's Twitter handle. It's been a lot of fun. It makes all these conversations a little bit better. And we definitely have a really great show for you this time, talking about something, like I said, the horror genre that we don't get to address very often, because it's not very often that we get really smart horror. So here it is, episode 73, It Follows and the Stigma of Sex. Movie theaters are modern-day pulpits. Real World Theology exists to shed a light on the narratives that are shaping our culture and to encourage viewers to recognize that entertainment is not mindless. So, I guess the thing that I'd want to start by asking both of you guys is, like, are either of you really into horror movies? Like, do you watch, like, X number of horror movies a year? Or do, like, you have to, like, really hear something about a movie, like a horror or a scary movie, before you'd go see it? Or do you typically like that genre?
Yeah, well, I don't really, like, I've not liked horror movies almost ever, because my sister loves them. And she grew up, like, watching all the Scream movies and everything. And just those were like her favorite go-to scary movies growing up. So I remember watching, my sister's like 4 years younger than me. So, I'm a great role model. So like at 16, my 12-year-old sister is watching Scream. I would watch those with her and she would be like, these are great. Let's watch more. And I'd be like, I need to go to bed. And then I couldn't sleep for like 2 days. Cause I'm like, there's a murderer. I live in white suburbia. I'm going to get murdered. I never really liked them. And it was actually interesting. I was having somebody brought it up. Blaine and I are both in the Christ in Pop Culture members only group. And Blaine, was it you that brought it up about horror movies? Brought up Josh Larson's article?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, and I think I mentioned something kind of in a long comment about how I really didn't like horror movies until after I became a Christian, because I wasn't as scared as I am by them anymore. Whereas, like, horror movies before terrified me, because they basically were like, hey, you're going to die. And I was like, I don't want to die.
how were you like?
I don't want to die. No. So there was like this terrible, like, it would bring to the forefront just the idea that you could be horribly, brutally murdered, and that, you know, like, there is punishment, and there is death, and there is fear and terror, and I don't want to say cure, but there's no counterbalance to fear and death apart from faith in Christ. And so when I became a Christian, strangely enough, I started to like horror movies a lot more, because I feel like there was this counterbalance now of not being afraid of what's on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I caught up on things that I never would have watched when I wasn't a Christian. Things like, you know, Friday the 13th and Halloween and all those different movies, and Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, all those different movies, I finally caught up on them because I was able to approach them, you know, in a way where I was able to actually watch it and think about the movies, where before I was just thinking about how I was going to make it through without, you know, soiling myself. And so, you know, like, strategically never had a girlfriend, except for I went on one date where she wanted to go see a scary movie, but it wasn't scary. It was Freddy versus Jason.
Yeah, that's a comedy.
Which is not scary. It is ridiculous. It's kind of like, you know, Jason in space. You know, it's just one of those ridiculous movies. And that was one of the few of those ridiculous, like, slasher films that made it to a big screen release. So, you know, that kind of defined. And so I've dabbled. I'm not into horror. You know, I'm not diving deep into the horror genre because it's a huge genre. But I found, especially since I started writing regularly and seeing movies regularly, I've enjoyed the movies that have been good within the horror genre. So there's, like, you know, this movie, It Follows, and one of my favorite movies of the year. It's kind of not really a horror film, but it's a smaller movie called Spring. That's a really great kind of movie that uses horror and suspense, but it's not really about the horror as much as it is in It Follows. Mm-hmm. That's another movie that I really, really enjoyed from this year. I think that's pretty much the only horror movies I've seen this year, except for maybe catching up on some random ones.
Yeah. So you're saying, like, if something came out like a horror or a deep thriller, kind of slash horror genre movie came out, you're obviously not like the, oh, I got to see it because of what it is.
Right.
You would go in response to either things you've heard, reviews, or something like that. Someone would recommend it to you, then you'd go check it out and not be afraid of the genre, but not seek the genre out.
Right. Yeah. But I know that there's a large segment of the population that does. They go see horror movies just because they're horror movies.
Mm-hmm.
Because
they like to be scared.
You know, I don't know. You know, and with you know, October coming up, and that's typically a month where people, like, especially people who write about movies and talk about them a lot, tend to focus a lot more on horror movies. I've tended to try and catch up, like, you know, I watched Cabin in the Woods for the first time last year, and I was just like, that was really great. Like, I wish all horror movies were that good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but, you know, I've been trying to catch up, and, you know, everything from, like, you know, last year I kind of made it a goal to watch some of the ones that were on Netflix or the ones that were bigger. So, like, you know, I reviewed and watched Event Horizon last year, and that was kind of weird and strangely sadistically gory.
Oh, it's so good. I mean, like, yeah, I watched her Event Horizon last year, I think 4 times to prep for.
Wow.
Our,
that's amazing.
Well, I mean, I kept pulling something new out of it every time I watched it, because it was one of the big things that I used for our talk down at Baylor.
Right.
When I got to go down there with JR and some of our other friends. So, just seeing that type of movie it was just so different and cool.
Mm-hmm.
But I speaking of October, I want to remind anyone who doesn't know, one of my favorite things to do is during the year, we always do a couple extra podcasts outside of our normal, three a month schedule. And it's because I don't think horror movies are especially seen by Christians, but represented very well by Christians. We always do a Halloween episode. And it's always one of my favorites because typically we get to do something that's been out for a while. And we got to do Cabin in the Woods last year, and it was just so cool to talk about this in light of kind of like what you're saying, like, you know, like how would you have seen the movie before, but then like bringing Christian lenses to it, or bringing like a lens of just like faith, like how that changes what you're seeing. So I'm looking forward again to recording another Halloween episode this year. It's actually, I've been excited about this like all year. And so it's one of those things that I can't wait to get to, but that is a tangent, because I also want to know kind of where you land, Blaine, on this whole thing. Like, where are you on the horror spectrum?
Yeah, so I have a similar story to Josh's. For most of my life, I avoided horror movies, and I can kind of trace that back to a really traumatic experience I had when I was 10 years old or younger. I think I was a little younger with The Exorcist. It was around Halloween time, and so like most kids, I was like, "Mom, I want to watch a scary movie," and maybe not the best display of wisdom ever in the history of parenting.
And your mom, who didn't love you,
she put on The Exorcist, and I didn't make it all the way through it, and it messed me up. I mean, now that I look back on it and what it did to me, I probably actually should have gotten counseling. I mean, I didn't sleep for a month. And I'm not exaggerating. Like, I couldn't sleep. I would go sit outside my mom's door and cry every night because I was afraid Satan was going to come get me. I mean, it really messed me up. And so that kind of put a bad taste in my mouth as far as horror movies go, you know, starting at, you know, that age. And so I've kind of avoided them. But in the past year and a half, and I don't really know what started this. I remember reading some stuff from some Christians like Josh Larson, and I really can't remember who else I'd love to give credit, but on horror and talking about how good it is. And so I, you know, kind of started, I decided to dip my toe back into that pool, if you will. And I've realized since then, I like horror a lot. And it's just totally, in the past year and a half, my view of horror movies has completely changed. And I've realized, and part of this is due to the fact that, you know, I'm a Christian now, kind of like you were saying, Josh. But I realized that horror is a fundamentally spiritual genre. And I've realized that horror is very rarely about the thing that's out there, or, you know, the monster, the killer, whatever. It's about what we fear as a society, as individuals, as a culture, right? And that's fascinating to look at, not only as a member of the culture, but as a Christian. It's really fascinating and really insightful. So I like horror movies a lot. I feel like... Josh, what you said resonates with me as well. I feel like I'm doing a lot of catching up. There's still a lot of great things that I haven't seen. I'm trying to see all of the classic horror movies, and I'm watching them more. I don't necessarily just go see something just because it's horror, but I'm watching them pretty often now. Mm-hmm. And actually, I mean, It Follows is probably my second favorite movie of the year so far. Loved it. And the Babadook
of any genre
was one of and then the Babadook from last year was might have been my favorite. Yes. I loved it, and I found a very encouraging film. My journey.
So that's a good point, that, you know, we're talking about this movie, or let me rephrase this, since we don't often do horror movies on this podcast, I mean, there's various reasons. I think most of them, because even though we've all kind of talked about how there's value in horror films, like any genre, you know, there's like good examples and bad examples. And I'd say most horror movies are put out because they're more shock than they are substance. And I think that's a valid criticism that lots of horror movies get. And I mean, if you want to know more about horror movies, like in one of the first podcasts that we did, I got to interview James Harleman, who's been on the show a couple times since, and we talk about horror movies and his transition to horror and the things that Christians can learn from horror movies, and I think you guys made some valid points too. But obviously there is something about It Follows that we think goes deeper than your run-of-the-mill, like, paranormal thriller. So what I would ask is, what is it that really set apart It Follows for you when you saw it, Blaine?
So I'm a sucker for things that are meta, and meta in a smart way.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'd mentioned in my review that I did for you guys of The Visit. See, I already forgotten the title. It's that bad. It's trying to be meta, but it doesn't really work.
Mm-hmm.
It Follows is a really good example of a horror film that is meta and does it well. So the thing that I loved about the film is that It Follows is that it takes this the trope that sex equals death, which we see in basically every horror movie, certainly every slasher film, right? You have sex outside of wedlock, mm-hmm. and you deserve to die. And it takes that trope that other horror movies have been, and it takes these ideas that other horror movies play with in a subtle way, and it just explodes it and toys with it in a very deliberate way. Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was brilliant, a brilliant thing to do, and the way the film explores those issues, which I'm sure we'll talk about more in depth.
Mm-hmm.
But I loved that. And then I loved even how, as it was doing that, it was doing it so self-consciously, like even down to the score, you know, sounds very John Carpenter-esque with this synthesizer heavy heavy score, which I love. So yeah.
No. Well, let's get Josh. What was it about It Follows that ranked it high, and then made you want to come and talk about it, but recommend it to other people?
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, you know, I think the thing is, like, maybe this is kind of what makes my enjoyment of horror, you know, because the two movies that I mentioned earlier, Spring and this movie, It Follows, both are they're not like what a normal horror movie is. And I know I've actually read some critiques of this movie that said that it could have used a little bit more blood and guts in it, because it didn't really major on that at all. Like, there's really not much of anything in it. And so maybe that's why, one of the reasons why it was easily digestible for me, as far as like being able to think through the themes when I watched the movie, is that I wasn't, you know, cause I'm not really the biggest fan of blood and guts, you know, like I still cringe, like when I watch Braveheart and, you know, those kind of movies, like I'm not really a big fan of like seeing blood everywhere. But anyways, what really, you know, reiterating what Blaine said, it definitely is a great meta movie as far as, you know, speaking to something, you know, that actually like our culture is thinking about and talking about like currently.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a lot of things to think about in this movie. And that's what I really appreciate. It wasn't one reading of the movie that was so completely obvious. But I think that it dealt with one particular issue. You know, I mean, like you said, Blaine, most horror movies are dealing on this level of addressing issues of sexuality and, you know, I mean, it could deal with promiscuity or like the consequences of sex. And I feel like this movie did an incredibly great job of addressing those things, but also letting you read it a little bit and nuancing it so that you can kind of pull some different things from it, as a result of that. And, you know, just on a personal resonance level, I've counseled some people, and I have direct experience in dealing with sexual trauma and those kind of things. And so the movie spoke on a really deep personal level about like the consequences and the baggage that comes with either being, you know, sexually exploited or just having a promiscuous sexual life. And so those kind of things really just I could see. When I was reading the movie, I could see those things in it. And so I was reading a lot of that in the movie, you know, not from a trope standpoint, but really kind of on a deeper and psychological plane, you know, that what the monster of this movie was. And so that's really what I was taking from it, why it made it stand out from maybe some other horror movies. But like, again, I don't have a ton of experience and I've only watched the really good horror movies to get caught up. So, you know, I haven't dabbled in some of the fringier elements of the horror genre, or even the more modern stuff that's vamping on, you know, the classics. Mm-hmm. So, I felt like this definitely fell in the strain of, and I know that a bunch of people have labeled this kind of like a new classic of the horror genre, mm-hmm. Because it does a great job of taking some of those historical tropes, or just historical themes, and treating them in a way that's not overblown or sensationalistic, but also kind of nuances it for the modern era of, you know, teenagers and relationships and those kind of things.
So what I think both of you guys are talking about, especially Blaine, when you talk about how the movie is meta, but like smart meta, it does remind me a lot about Cabin in the Woods, how it took ideas, tropes from the genre, and didn't just have a movie where you made sure you check those off, but it said, what is it about this thing that you see in horror movies, this particular item? Why is it that way? Or why do we continue to see this? Or what is it about this idea that frightens us? And like we do with every movie, we are not going to really walk that line of non-spoiler. So we're going to talk about the movie from start to finish. So if you haven't seen it, and a lot of this movie, I think it works on rewatch, even if you know kind of how it ends. But I would encourage you, like with most films, to watch the film, because not knowing the ending, not knowing kind of where the movie goes, does add a lot to the paranoia that the film, the director is able to, that David Robert Mitchell is able to capture through how he films this and how he kind of sets it up and writes it and lets the story unfold. So mm-hmm. I don't want to ruin any of that for anyone who's listening, but continue to listen anyway if you just want to. But the basic idea behind this film is that we have Jay, who is a late teenage girl, and she has this sexual encounter that seems, you know, unfortunately run of the mill for a teenager. And then she is then told that a curse has been passed to her, and unless she passes it on to someone else via sex, she will be followed by some type of mysterious, unidentified creature that will eventually catch her and kill her. And the creature doesn't like run after her or or do anything crazy like that. It just slowly follows her wherever she goes. And it's always, you know, it's almost always a couple steps behind, and it's this lingering thing. And she has to almost get rid of this curse before it gets back to her. But then, as the rules go, if she does pass it on to someone and they are killed by the creature, then it just kind of goes back and hits the person before them. So we have this very interesting rule set that kind of sets this movie apart from almost anything else. And we find our hero or heroine, Jay, in a very interesting situation, socially, and sexually. So it makes it very awkward. And I can see how lots of people would avoid the film just because they're like, when I told people, I was like, they're like, oh, is that horror movie about having sex? And I was like, well, yes, but no. I mean, like, because like you guys have said, there's more to it. And both of you guys have mentioned how this thematically mirrors some fears that we have socially, some fears especially that teenagers have, that young adults have, and some stigmas that we have. And Blaine, I was wondering if you could kind of explain to people how the narrative of this film mirrors the fear or the stigma of sexually transmitted diseases, because I think you did a really good job of kind of walking, briefly walking people through it in your review that you did for the site. And if you could just kind of show how the way the story unfolds brings to light lots of those fears.
Cool. So the interesting thing about It Follows is that it does a really good job of showing that as a culture, no matter what we say is very different from how we believe, right? We say all of these things, but this movie really shows, I think, what we believe and what we fear as a culture, in the sense that it shows that sex is never just a physical act, right? At least not in our minds,
mm-hmm.
right? That's not the way our culture perceives sex and sexual acts, even though our culture says that that's what it is, right? It's just this biological Darwinian need that you have to fulfill with no sort of spiritual, you know, I mean, it's very naturalistic. There's nothing spiritual to it at all.
Anything attached to it.
Right. There's nothing to it. It's just physical. This movie shows that that is not how we feel about sex as a culture, even though we lie to ourselves. Because it shows that sex actually does have consequences, and that we are actually very afraid of sex itself. Obviously, because this shape-shifting thing, right, it's never named, it's never called an STD or anything like that, but it very clearly is just a physical manifestation of our internal fear of sexually transmitted diseases. So I think the film does a really good job of just highlighting that sort of lie that we've bought into and we sell ourselves as a culture through, you know, other forms of media, mm-hmm. conversation or whatever. And I think it's really valuable for that reason alone.
Because if it wasn't the case, do you think this movie would actually have a lot of the suspense that it does if there wasn't something deep-seated in us that has a fear of
right.
the
yeah.
stigma that follows sexual encounters, or you know, it's there. I say consequences, but I don't necessarily mean bad. But like when you are sexually involved with someone, there are social and psychological and sometimes physical things that come away from that encounter. It's not. If kind of like you say, if we actually believe what we said and not what we feel, I don't feel like this movie would have been near as suspenseful or kind of scary or have that weight that it carries.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I guess I should add a caveat to that. This isn't anything new in horror films. Mm-hmm. Horror films have been doing this since the beginning, talking about this fear of sex and sexual activity. They've just been doing it in a more veiled form, right? It's kind of Freudian. It just kind of slips in there, so to speak. But the really cool thing that this movie is doing, that I think David Robert Mitchell is doing, is saying, hey, no, I'm going to point this out to you that we actually are afraid of this thing. And it's, you know, the elephant in the room that needs to be talked about.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought it was really, really good at bringing that to the forefront in a new and fresh way, and not just kind of rehashing it in a, you know, meta way that's not, in the end of the day, it's not really that significant. I think this film really is significant and will be seen as such, you know, in
for some time
days of future past.
Well, okay, so one of the things that I really enjoy about taking a look at films the way we do here at Real World Theology is understanding, being able to understand culture being able to understand where films are going because you understand the culture that's consuming them. And I want to phrase this right so I make sure I'm asking it right, but I hope it's not too far reaching to ask if most of our horror films, that thing that we see, the thing that we've already mentioned, that anyone who has sex in a horror film is going to die. Like that's what we know. That's the thing that we can almost count on since, you know, the beginning of the horror genre, because there is something that says, oh, we see the teenagers going off by themselves in the woods to fornicate, and we know something in us says that that's wrong, and that we know they're not going to survive because of it. And in fact, the only person who's going to survive, again, we, you know, this is one of the things they played with in Cabin in the Woods, is that the only one that's going to survive is the virgin, the innocent, the person who doesn't have anything that needs to be punished. Even though in almost every horror movie, the villain is almost always indiscriminate. You know, like Freddy or Jason, whoever it is, Scream, they're not just picking the most sinful people. They're indiscriminately killing whoever's near them. But the way the narrative always unfolds is that, you know, the innocent people are always more aware of the surroundings. They're in a better place to fight off the horror, the monster, the bad guy. And people who let their guard down and do things that are socially stigmatized or socially unacceptable always find themselves the first to go. But in this film, our main character who is having all the sex at the end is still not dead, at least at that point. And we're not even sure if the monster is alive at the end, which is another thing. But does it show that there is maybe a cultural shift in what we feel needs to be punished? Seeing as how in this movie, it's not the virgin who is the heroine. It is the person who is having all the sex. Does that reflect maybe something about what we're afraid of as a culture, or what we actually, like, you know, again, we wouldn't verbalize, but our actions and our feelings follow in a different way, that there's this shift that's been made.
Interesting. I definitely think that, to answer your question with one word answers, yes.
Cool. Well, we're done here.
Excellent. All right. Everyone, thanks. Have a good night. I think that it is sort of a cultural shift, but I think it's also a growing understanding of sex that's shifting within our culture as well. I don't think that this is a fully formed idea in my mind, just because I wasn't thinking in that direction until you asked that question. But I think that it's a change away from that, where we can almost look at within our hyper sexualized culture, we sort of almost have to shift the conversation a little bit sometimes because of the consequences of what our culture has done to sex and sexual relationships and things like that. I don't think it can really get into, like, you know, soapboxing, like, we need to go back to Freddy just killing all the people having sex. But I think it does, to a certain extent. It definitely addresses and I don't want to say affirms, but it's out there, you know, as that sex is definitely something different than what it used to be. But I don't think that that's necessarily fully a bad thing. But I want to let Blaine answer before we would go any further down that road.
So this is a really easy answer. I don't know. I'm still...
yeah.
And again, we're done here.
Still really conflicted. Yeah. No, I'm still really conflicted. And I still don't know entirely how to read the film as a whole. I mean, not that there's one way. I don't have a firm footing.
Well, okay.
It's not an answer.
So let me... may posit this a little bit and say that I would say the audiences and culture in general has taken it for granted that, much like most of the shared morality of culture, like, there's certain things people know they should do or shouldn't do, whether they, you know, like I said, admitted it verbally or acknowledged it, you know, to another person or not. And there has been a culture for a long time, especially around sex and sexuality, that you don't, like, those are forbidden topics. Those are forbidden ideas. You don't talk about sex openly. You don't engage in sex, especially outside of marriage. Even though it's one of those things, like, everyone's doing it, but no one's talking about it. It reminds me of when his latest comedy special, Jim Gaffigan's talking about people who eat at McDonald's. And how no one ever admits eating a McDonald's.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he's like, they sell 600 million hamburgers a day. There's only 300 million people in America. Everyone's lying, you know?
Yeah.
So, like, everyone says sex is terrible. Don't do it outside of marriage. And I don't think we would disagree with that. You know, like, not that sex is terrible, but that there is a time and place for it. But everyone's like, don't do it. It'll ruin everything about you. It needs to be punished. It needs to be put on, stigmatized. And like I said, we keep using that word stigmatized because there is like a stigma to it. It's how we have to read the Scarlet Letter in high school or whatever. So like we get that, and that was the way people thought, but now people are progressing their view on sex. I think both Christian and non-Christian, because I noticed there's been like a resurgence for Christians to say, wait a minute, let's stop saying sex is bad. Let's say sex is great. Sex is awesome. It was created for awesome, awesome, awesome reasons. Yep. And in the right context, it's one of the best things in the entire world. So let's stop spinning a false narrative. So let's realize that it's complicated. And on the other side of the coin, people who aren't Christian or are coming into their own kind of maybe humanist view, like just do what makes you feel good. They're like, why am I feeling bad about something that I enjoy? And so they're also saying, you know, sex isn't black and white anymore. It's not do it and it's bad. It needs to be punished. Sex is complicated. And it needs to be addressed as complicated. And so whether you're Christian or non-Christian, your view on sex has shifted in culture since, you know, the 50s or whenever we're making, you know, basic horror movies. And a movie like It Follows, all it's really doing is years after the shift has probably been made, is pointing out that the stigma that comes with sex is complicated. It's not as easy as you had sex in the back seat of a car and now you're going to be the next person that dies. There's other things going with it. So Blaine, I think you want to jump in.
No, that's great. I see exactly what you're going for now. And, I completely agree. I think that's one thing that this film, that's another thing. I keep saying one thing. It's another thing that the film does really well. I would say that it answers this in a thoroughly Christian way.
Yeah.
But it answers it in a much more helpful way than the stereotypical uber conservative sort of answer that most horror films give.
Yeah.
And it's just what you were saying, is that it's not you have sex, you die, therefore sex is evil and sex is bad, and it always equals death. Because that's not what these characters do in this film. And actually, if I can go ahead and talk about the end.
Oh, yeah.
The way I read the film... and I'm curious to see if anybody reads it like this. So the very last shot of the film shows Jay and the guy.
I think it's Paul.
Paul. Jay and Paul holding hands and walking down the street. You see their faces. And then, of course, in the background, you see this person kind of following them. You don't know whether it's you know, then the question is it the thing or is it not?
Mm-hmm.
And I actually tend to read the film in a positive light and say where their monogamy, their commitment to one another, has actually stopped this, you know, cyclical curse.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of how I read the film. So I do see it as very much an indicator of a shifting understanding of how complicated and how spiritual sex itself is, even. That it's not something to be feared, and then of course as Christians, you know, we say that it's, you know, it is, like you said, it's one of the best gifts that God has given to people, except that He's, you know, ordained it to work in certain parameters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think this film is close. I mean, I think you could even say, in the words of Jesus, it's not far from the kingdom of God. It's close. It's very, very positive in understanding that sex is spiritual and metaphysical, not just in a negative sense, but also in a positive sense.
Yeah.
I don't know if that...
No, no, it does, because what you're saying ultimately about like God's vision of sex reminds me a lot of when people... And people come from different traditions, and I don't want to raise one tradition over the other necessarily, but lots of Protestant traditions will do what they call like fencing the table mm-hmm. when it comes to communion. You know, they say, mm-hmm. You know, if you're a believer, come to the table, take this sacrament that God has given us for, you know, uplifting and encouragement in the body and in with relationship with him. But like most things, if you come for the wrong reasons or you come and you're not a believer, it's actually going to work to harden your heart, or it's this good thing and you come at it from the wrong way and it's going to actually do the opposite of what you want, which is, I think, what a lot of things that in creation happen, like if they're misused, they're incredibly powerful things that have been created, and like I don't want to give them too much power, but you know, used in the right way, like sex is one of the most unifying and spiritual things that you can do with another human being,
mm-hmm.
and but used in the wrong way, it can be one of the most destructive, and just like emptying. And like I said, have those consequences, like socially, psychologically, and physically, if it's used in a way that it was not designed for. Which when you start talking about that, especially in modern culture, you kind of sound like a teetotaler, and people are like, "Oh gosh, you're one of those people. Why can't you just get with the program?" And you know, like I said, the thing that I would hope would eventually come out of it is the understanding that there is an ideal that should be strived for, but humans are humans, and there should be a little bit of grace and forgiveness, because you know, very few people are making it to marriage anymore without having some kind of sexual encounter,
mm-hmm.
And it's like I said, it's the McDonald's thing. There's like so few people making it, but everyone has a high horse about it. Like, people need to come down off their high horse just a little bit. Why not? You know, not compromising their view of it, but
well, you know what's fascinating to me about all of this is, at least I don't know if you have this problem, Josh. You're in Wisconsin, right?
Yeah.
And Mikey, you're in North Carolina. So in the Bible Belt down here, we have this, you know, this constant notion. You have these people that are like, well, Hollywood, all these liberals, and I'm not going to watch this and that. And Hollywood. All this. If you actually think about it, a lot of these movies are very conservative. It follows. Most horror movies are fundamentally conservative. Sex equals death. That's a conservative notion.
Mm-hmm.
Trainwreck, the best romantic comedy, certainly this year so far, and in the past few years, I would argue, is, you know, fundamentally has a conservative message. Now,
mm-hmm.
It's you don't want to conflate conservative with Christian at all. I'm not saying those are the same things. I'm saying it's conservative.
Yeah.
Not saying it's Christian. But but it's just interesting because Hollywood has this, and rightly so, right? There are a lot of people who are politically liberal in Hollywood. And,
hey, real quick on that, Blaine. Like, since you dropped Trainwreck, explain how that works in Trainwreck real quick.
Yeah,
for people who haven't seen Trainwreck, because I imagine that on the whole, lots of people probably listening haven't seen Trainwreck.
So the cool thing about Trainwreck is it takes the traditional romantic comedy conventions where man is, what's the word? I'm trying to think of an appropriate.
I would say he's like infidel, like he infidel.
All I can think of is libertine, but that's like so.
Non-committal.
He sleeps with every woman he sees. Mm-hmm. He's that guy. He's that jerk. And so, you know, that guy in romantic comedies, you know, eventually meets one woman and he fights it for a long time. Oh, you know, I can't be tied down. And of course, he gets married and he's monogamous. And so, monogamy is the answer. Conservative notion. Well, Trainwreck does the same thing basically, but it's really cool because it flips it on its head, where it's the woman who is the one who sleeps around with all the guys and doesn't want to be held down, and it's just straight up hilarious. So, yeah, that's what Trainwreck is all about,
and that's how it fits into that conservative, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, because romantic comedies are you know, traditionally that sort of conservative narrative. Mm-hmm. And again, I don't want any, you know, I'm not saying it's Christian. It's certainly not in most cases. I'm just saying it's conservative, and the two aren't the same. Contrary to a lot of what we have down here in the South, too. So. Anyway, soapbox.
Sorry.
Do you guys mind if I go on a bit of a train of thought that connects Trainwreck and your question from before?
Do it.
If we say right. No, is it going to matter?
No, because I'm going to do it anyway.
He's going to do it anyway.
I'm going to do it anyway. So, because I thought, you know, because I was thinking back to, like, the idea of, like, I recently watched Apatow's first film that he directed, 40-Year-Old Virgin.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the common thing, the surprising message of it, you know, of 40-Year-Old Virgin is that, you know, there's all these guys here that kind of had the same mentality, like that mentality you were talking about, Blaine, where, you know, there's a casualness to sex, and that it's like, you know, they're talking about, like, their sex is, you know, sexual exploits. And the surprising message of that is just, you know, like the view of the 40-year-old version that, like, there's significance and weight to, like, your first sexual experience, actually has a lot of merit. And the movie's not just about, like, oh, can he finally get that first score? It's like, no, he actually, like, the movie ends, spoiler alert for anyone who hasn't seen that movie, like, it ends with him, the first time he has sex is after he gets married. Like, what? You know, it's just this crazy, you know, and so I thought that was really interesting. And I think that It Follows does a little bit of the same thing, just in a different way, of kind of pushing back against the common cultural understanding of sex as a casual, no strings attached encounter that just, you know, like we mentioned early on, you know, just it satiates that animal or, like, Darwinian hunger that we have. But also I think that it goes at, like, there's a hunger for intimacy and connection, because I think, you know, the whole movie, Paul kind of leers longingly at Jay and then finally gets, you know, to have mm-hmm. sex with her. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that resonates with every nerd who didn't have sex in high school. So, you know, because it's like you had that crush, you know, growing up, and you were just like, you know, if I could just be with her, like, I would be significant. And that goes kind of back to what a little bit you talked about of that reading of this idea of the monster being sexually transmitted disease, where Paul's basically like, I will take on this sexually transmitted disease because I get to, you know, I get to have sex with Jay. And mm-hmm. so it's, you know, there's that little underscore reading. But, you know, it's not that normal horror movie trope of, like, sex being, you know, inherently bad or evil. It's actually, you know, we said that idea is actually probably not that Christian. It's actually more of a Platonic idea, which is not how we look. Mm-hmm. We look at sex from a Christian standpoint, or even like from a Judeo-Christian, like from a Jewish Old Testament Bible standpoint. That's not how we look at sex. So, you know, it's not that there. And the great thing is that, like, none of them died. Like, none of them get a machete to the face, you know, or something like that. You know, there's a deeper, more holistic understanding. So it's like, on this deeper spiritual and psychological plane, there's, like, this monster. And kind of one of the readings that I thought of the movie, besides just the sexually transmitted disease idea, was this idea that, and I know some reviewers have, like, you know, poo-pooed this idea that, you know, that this monster, this manifestation of the monster is, like, is the manifestation of, like, a person's sexual past and, like, the previous person in the cursed chain. Like, I think there's a couple scenes that kind of play with this idea that there's some consequence to, like, our previous sexual encounters, whether they're good or bad. And like you said, Mikey, the consequences can be good or bad, but there's, like, this reading of, that potentially, like, our sexual past sticks with us. You know, I think it was friend of the show, Wade Bearden, said on one of their – I think it was one of their first episodes of Seeing Believing for Christ in Pop Culture, he said something about, you know, that, like, the It Follows, like the it that follows you is the, you know, the sexual encounters, not necessarily like, you know, an STD or like the loss of innocence or virginity or whatever. So, but I think that on an even deeper level than that, kind of backing up just a little bit, is like this idea that something that I've heard a couple people mention, but not expand on too much, is the idea, or the, there are basically just like in, I think it's Nightmare on Elm Street, or maybe it's,
Friday the 13th.
Yeah. That there's just a lack of adults or parents in the movie. And that the only adults that we do get in the movie, they're either obscured. So, like, I think there's one scene where you see Jay's mom talking to somebody in their kitchen, but both of their faces are facing away from the camera in such a way that we don't actually see them. And so or the adults are, like, off screen or they're out of focus. And I intentionally went back and looked to make sure I wasn't just kind of like imagining this reading of the movie, but the only time that we see adults is when they're the manifestation of the It Follows, or it's, like the moviegoers at the movie theater that, Jay and Hugh go to early on in the movie. So, but there's like this, there's multiple occasions within the movie where like the group of friends, they say they should call the police, or they say, we should talk to our parents. And each time they sort of just dismiss the idea just wholesale. Like, you know, the only time that we see the adults is just, you know, it's not anything that has any consequence toward the plot or toward the plight of these teenagers at that point in the movie. Like, I think I'm reading that right. And I think that that kind of speaks, and I don't know if that's what David Robert Mitchell was going for, but I think that it can be read as that's like a sad component of the, of like our sex saturated culture, is this, there's a lack of adult intervention in the sexual life of teenagers and young adults. So there's like,
or at least like, openness, right?
Like, right. Exactly. Well, yeah.
Have that conversation.
Right. It's like a symptom and a cause of sort of the liberation of sex from like, from the normal mores of like faith and commitment. Just, you know, like parental involvement or like adult involvement, like you were saying, Mikey, is that like sex is like uncomfortable for young adults, and it's even uncomfortable for adults and parents to talk about, you know, like this sexual liberation, like, oh, we have to talk about it now. You know, it's not something where it's like you get married and then you just figure it out. that's not how it happens anymore. And so there's like this sad absence in the movie of adults to come alongside Jay and her friends. It's like, if they just talked to an adult, maybe this whole thing would have been avoided, you know, or something like that. I think it speaks to how our culture just doesn't have, we as adults are uncomfortable and kids are uncomfortable and we don't want to talk. We don't want to develop healthy sexual norms for kids because we're afraid to talk, because we're just afraid that they'll lose their virginity or they'll get an STD.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's what we're afraid of. So there's like that unwillingness. And so I think it kind of speaks to that unwillingness. But then also kind of going back to what I said before, I think that there's a compounding of the sexual confusion and like dysfunction that we see of the roles of parents. Because there's, like I said, I think I'm reading this, I don't want to say right, because I don't think a movie can, if you're reading it, you know, if it's a good movie, you can read it a little bit differently. Like, you know, I'm not saying all this being like Blaine is totally wrong and his review should be taken off the site or something. you know, but I like, there's like this hinted narrative of sexual abuse and sexual brokenness among some of the characters in the movie. So there's like these subtle intimations, and like, I think I counted three separate sequences and I can't remember the third one right now. I wish I would have written them down. I looked back at my notes on the movie and I couldn't find it in there anywhere. The third one, but like there's the one where the neighbor across the street, whatever his name is, the guy that she
sleeps with,
yeah, the guy that she sleeps with to sort Greg. Of pass it on, yeah, he, when he dies in the movie, which he's one of the few that do die, he's not connected to the friends, so it's okay if he dies. but you know, he he dies because his mom, it's his mom who is manifested as, you know, the one who kills him. And then in kind of like one of the more disturbing parts of the movie, she's like in a sexual position when he's dead on top of him. And so it's like, I almost get this reading, and I think there's an intimation that like something, there was like a weird sexual dynamic in that household at some point. I like I said, I can't remember the specifics, but there's almost like this hint of like this idea that maybe there was almost like a broken sexual past in that home as well as in Jay's home as well. And so there's all these intimations that I think we can almost make a reading that like the idea of, because of sexual liberation, because of what sex has become nowadays, like sexual trauma and psychological sexual damage, like has consequences within how we view and approach sex, as individuals, both as teenagers and adults. So like, there's not, I think the overall thing is like the movie shows that there's a gravity to sex, and like, that's not necessarily a Christian idea, but Blaine, like you said, it's not that far from a Christian reality of like sex and intimacy. Mm-hmm. Is that sex and intimacy is supposed to be a joyful, connected relationship. And like, I never had thought that that final shot is there, but I feel like that ties some of the ideas in my head together, that if that person walking behind in the distance at that last shot with Jay and Paul, you know, if there's a hopeful reading for that, that it could almost be read as that, you know, there is, when there's joyful, connected relationship. Now, granted, they don't look very joyful in the final shot. They're not like skipping down the sidewalk. Like, that would kind of defeat the purpose and the tone of the whole movie if like all of a sudden it was just like, you know, the sun was shining and they're skipping together. Yeah. Like, isn't it great that we finally decided to commit to each other and this monster's gone? But, you know, like that, I think the movie has something to say that like, sex is important and there should be joyful connection in our relationships and not just a casual approach to it, because of both the fact that it's important and also because like sex can be a seriously messed up thing for people. So, you know, and that goes back to what I talked about before, like this idea that I've counseled and dealt and know personally people who have like been sexually assaulted, have been raped, things like that, where sex is really hard for them because of what they've gone through. And so I think that that has an interesting dynamic that plays in the movie.
Mm. Yeah.
So there was my rabbit trail. So I'm done.
I like what you brought up too, about the parents being absent. And I think, I mean, this is one of the telltale signs that, you've got a good movie on your hands when, like you said, Josh, it can sustain multiple layered readings, right? Right. Where it's not like our job here is to be like, no, this is right, no, that is right. But there's, I think there's, your readings are absolutely valid. And the stuff about the parents being gone really is really important with one scene that a lot of people, at least a lot of the reviews that I read, sort of nitpicked about when they go to the pool to try and kill it.
Yeah.
About how dumb that, you know, a lot of, I read a lot of reviews and people were like, oh, that's so stupid. That's a dumb scene. You know, why would anybody do that? Well, there's no parents. Like,
right.
It's just like every other Spielberg movie. Like, what are a bunch of kids going to do to try and, you know, fight something? You know, they don't know what it is. They're going to come up with a dumb plan that's not going to work.
Yeah.
It makes sense. I mean, they don't have any sort of, they don't have parents there to be able to say, no, that's a dumb idea. You shouldn't do that.
Right. You know, it, I mean, it's just like the outplaying of like what probably every episode of Scooby-Doo should have ended like, you know?
Right. And maybe even that you talk about something Freudian, the super Freudian thing with the mother, you know, raping the son.
Yeah.
Which was terribly disturbing, obviously.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I almost hesitated to bring it up because it's like, gee, I don't really want to talk about this.
Yeah. But it's like, I mean, that could in itself be a straight up indictment of, you know, the failures of parents. I mean, it's like, right, not only are you just not there, when you are there, like, you're screwing things up.
No.
And you're, you know.
Ayo.
So, I don't know. I really, you made a good point.
Yeah, when you talk,
talk about the indictment of parents. I think it goes even further than that. I think Josh hit on this too. Adults in general, like being unavailable to younger people, whether they're teens or even young adults, to educate them about like the uses and, like I said, again, I use the word consequences, but sometimes, you know, consequences are just like the repercussions of sexual encounters, and in the right way, those consequences can be great, socially and psychologically. Mm-hmm. But it's like the conversation we have in culture now, I guess in popular culture, we're like, what kind of sex ed should we have? You know, then there's the conservative approach that Blaine's mentioned before, where it's like, you know, abstinence or nothing, yeah. You know, and the fact that some people even see having conversations about sex as permissive to have sex.
Right.
Which I mean, I think is an unfortunate situation, because so many people, at least in that I've met along the way, you know, especially people stereotypically who grew up in maybe like homeschooled environments or stereotypically sheltered kind of areas, you know, they're told every day, like, sex is bad, sex is bad, sex is bad, sex is bad. And then they go and they get married, and suddenly, like, someone just flips a switch and sex is supposed to be amazing. Like, they are messed up because of the lack of education, the lack of adult just confidence and teaching that they've had in their life. So like they like people like either women or men, mm-hmm. walking into a marriage trying to have sex for the first time and then having to wrestle with this thing, like, I've been told that this is an evil thing for, you know, 18, 20, 25, 30 years, and suddenly it's supposed to be an amazing thing, and you can't just flip a switch. You can't be told not to touch something, and then, oh, it's fine to touch, you know. We told you before your hand would, like, burn and fall off, but now it won't. And, like, how are you supposed to, you know, like, where's the discipleship? Where's the slow, honest education in that? And I know it seems pretty indicting of adults' lack of communication or lack of involvement in the rearing and, I keep saying education, the education, especially sexually, of the uses of anything. Because I think this is true in any kind of hot button topic. Like, people are afraid to talk to their children about things that matter. You know, just don't do it. Just don't do it. Don't ask questions. Just don't do it. Like, why can't you go to this? Why can't you do this? What's this like? You know, just people like kids asking honest questions, and adults, even though they're physically there, they're emotionally not there. And I think we see that. And I think, Josh, you've hit a great thing. I think that's what we see in this film, as one of these subtle things. And hopefully, we've all kind of put our two cents in about the ending, and maybe, obviously not like a Christian view, but we have Paul, who has obviously had some type of crush, whether it be selfish or not, on Jay, our heroine, so to speak. And eventually, despite her sexual encounters, he still pines for her and still wants to be her savior to a certain degree. And and her hesitation is because she realizes that they're, you know, she kind of either likes Paul or Paul likes her, and doesn't want that sexual encounter to have more meaning than just a physical passing. And when they actually kind of, well, I won't say sit down, when they engage in their sexual encounter, it may be the movie is saying there is something else to this type of sexual encounter, and now they can move on with their lives having a healthy view and a healthy relationship of sex, which I don't think we would say is exceptionally healthy from our worldview, but relative to the other encounters we see in the movie, is the most healthy thing and almost redemptive of the act. Again, though we would not say it is redemptive in the Christian way, but redemptive comparatively to her other sexual encounters. And we hope, based on our reading, that that lingering shot of them walking in the distance isn't them being followed by it, but just, you know, that what if in the back of our mind. But if it's not, and this is where I would kind of flip the script, and I would say that personally I saw it as that probably was the monster, because I think it fits more in line with what we're seeing, where even with the best intentions, sexual encounters have consequences. And even though they, I don't want to use the word love, because I think that would be a stretch, but like I said, there is a pining, there is obviously more of an attraction between Jay and Paul than Jay and any of her other suitors, as it were.
Right.
So I think the lie would be to believe that just because he really, really liked her for a long time, their sexual encounter was really that much different than anyone else's. And I think they're confident that it is because there is some semblance of self-sacrifice or nobility to their sexual encounter. But ultimately, I don't think that would get rid of that monster. It would be cool to see that it didn't, and that there would have to be some other more pure self-sacrificing love that would actually defeat the unnamed anomalous monster. But we don't get that. So that's how I would read the ending different, just to be contrarian.
Yeah.
Because boom.
You know, it's interesting, though. I think the first time I saw it in the theater, I read it like that. And I guess part of it is maybe just because I've watched it a couple more times, and I don't know. You start to go crazy after you after you watch things a certain number of times, I guess. But so one of the cool things that Mitchell does with as far as his camera work goes is there are several different scenes where he plays with it being somewhere in the background. Yeah. You know, there's that very obvious one that's pointed out where there is a soccer player that's kind of walking toward them when they're all sitting out on the grass. And they make sort of a comedic relief moment out of that. And it's pointed out, but there's also a scene at the school where there's someone following them that probably is it, because you see it both going into the school and coming out. There are a couple of other scenes where you see something in the background walking, and you don't know whether it's the thing or not. And so I guess with the ending, what got me thinking about reading it the other way was, I mean, we know, you know, there's been no indication that you can kill this thing throughout the entire film. So if you just leave Jay and Paul alone walking together at the end without showing us anything, we have no reason to believe that thing is gone. But because Mitchell decided to put something in the background, I kind of got to thinking, well, what are you doing here? Why are you showing us something? We kind of know it's around. Yeah. It seemed like maybe he's opening up that possibility. So I don't know. Yeah. Mm. You're probably right. I mean, there's going to be a sequel, or there's been rumors of a sequel.
Well, I guess it did so well. Like anything, even if the story was already told, the almighty dollar says it was not finished.
Exactly.
Well, and I think that's part of the thing that's infuriated me, because any review or any interview that you read with Robert David Mitchell, he's just kind of like, oh yeah, that choice was just was supposed to make it like as screwed up as possible. You know, like I don't know if he's just trying not to tip his hand, or he's messing with the interviewers or whatever. But I read one particular interview where a couple choices that he made, he's just like, yeah, I just wanted him to be as, like, you know, messed up as possible. And that was kind of like, come on, man, don't ruin the movie for all of us who are taking it a lot more seriously than a lot of other people are.
Yeah.
So, and I don't know if maybe that's part of it, is it's like he doesn't really feel the need to give away. Because I know film directors can be kind of, they can be really dodgy about giving away, like, the motivations and, like, what they were actually going for. And, you know, sometimes it's better for the creative process for them to kind of be a little bit more vague, and leave it up to us to kind of come up with, you know, what the movie is saying. But I'm glad that I'm glad that he made that choice, though, that it wasn't just them walking down the street with nothing else. Cause I think that really leaves us with something it leaves us with this conversation, and it really does keep the thread of the movie going, that it's not just like, you know, like I said, it's just kind of like, those rascally kids, those darn kids got the plan to work. And, like, you know, the only thing is, did you guys, I was trying to look really closely, cause I actually, like, I rented this movie on iTunes and I watched it once, and then I went back and, like, watched it again and then paused and went backwards a bunch of times to kind of, like, put some pieces together. And I don't know if we really have time for that, but the it monster, when it comes into the pool, I was kind of reading it that might've almost been her father. Because her father was, like, absent, but I saw there's a family photograph in one quick jump cut. And I haven't been able to find if that's true or not. But I thought that was kind of interesting. And I guess that kind of just played into how I was reading it, like I explained before. But, like, I didn't know if, like, that, you know, because they asked her when the monster entered the pool. They ask Jay, you know, who is it, or what does it look like? And she says, you don't want to know.
Yeah.
I feel like, Josh, some of these theories that you're bringing up, it's not that they're invalid in any way. So don't hear that. But I feel like you should be making, like, videos of these theories because they'd make the video of the day over at Slash Film or something.
Nice. You know? Yeah.
I'm totally going to go look for that when we get done.
Yeah,
but that's interesting because that scene where she's like, you don't want to know. Yeah. And when she's like, you don't want to know, and then it shows the guy, I'm like, well, that ain't as scary as the mom raping the kid or
right, and I wasn't able to assault
victim peeing herself. It's just a dude.
Hmm.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that. Cool.
Well, we are getting about that time in the show, so I did want to shift a little bit to start wrapping it up, and I think this will let us cover the other big points that if we've left anything off. And so, like we typically do, we hit our come on moments, or just things that we wish were done a little bit different. And we obviously all enjoy this movie to varying degrees, but mostly in the positive. So it'll be interesting to see what you guys come up with. So, Blaine, was there something that you didn't like about this film or that you wish was done different?
I've been thinking about this since we started, and no, I can't think of anything significant.
Nothing.
No.
All right. Blaine,
I know it's not perfect, but.
Hey. But you can't Quentin Tarantino this one?
No.
All right, Josh.
Yeah, you know, I think that some people have had problems with that final and ending part of the movie with the pool scene and everything and kind of how it goes. You know, they say, oh, it's falling into the normal kind of tropes of horror films. And, you know, like I said, I've brought up Scooby-Doo twice now. And it's like, you know, some people have kind of, like, jokingly, you know, been like, you know, their review includes the word zoinks or jinkies towards the end when it talks about that part. And, you know, I think that the movie lags as far as the mood or the style that it's going for because of what they're trying to do in that situation. But, you know, since then, since watching the movie and kind of reading those reviews and thinking about it myself, you know, I really think that adds to it because of, Blaine, what you said, or that it's a bunch of kids, you know, like their plans are going to be cockamamie or kind of not really thought through that well. And, you know, but I even think that they did a good job of like, they're trying to do whatever they can to get their plan to work, you know, and like the initial plan doesn't really work the way they wanted it to. And like, they accidentally shoot somebody of their own party and like, you know, that kind of stuff. It's the kind of plans that you made when you were, you know, 17, 18, 19 years old. You didn't really think it through all the way before you pulled them off. But as far as anything else goes in the movie, I don't really think there are any, I don't think that there's anything else that I would really, that's not even a quibble. That's kind of like addressing someone else's quibble and then shooting it down.
It's the anti-quibble.
So I don't, you know, and that's what's great about movies. And that's why I like being able to revisit them. Cause I think that this, like It Follows, is going to be a movie that continues to climb, you know, in my top 10. Cause I think right now it's on the outside looking in, but I don't think it'll stay there. As I kind of revisit some of these movies again, just because you know, once you get around to those third viewings of movies, it's when you really start to look beyond even just the second viewing and start to appreciate it even more. So, and you rarely get to do that with a movie within a given year. And it's really great to be able to have an opportunity to do that and just see how great this movie is and then hope for the future. I mean, Robert David Mitchell has only made two movies. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's got a good future.
Yeah. And that's something that I would like to point out because you know, this again, we're recording this way after this movie actually came out.
Right.
And we're doing it because when this movie came out, not a ton of people saw it because it typically was in some of the smaller theaters and stuff like that. And it's gaining a lot of ground. It's hitting a lot of top 10 lists at midway point through the year. Kind of like what we talked about with Ex Machina. And I think it will continue to gain speed. And I think as people look back, it'll be like kind of like the Babadook, you know, like one of the movies that people keep pointing to. Like that was when someone got horror right. That was when they just didn't like churn out another Paranormal Activity or Sinister movie. You know, they gave it some depth. But with that, I'll be the contradiction. I had a problem with this movie, and I thought. I mentioned Quentin Tarantino earlier, and I think it's because him and I have one of the same gripes with this film. And maybe I'll put it in the show notes because he came out and said like, "Oh, it was really great, but here's a couple things I probably would have changed." You know, he wasn't even trying to like really criticize it. He was just kind of he seemed to be appreciating it, but kind of saying like, "Yeah, but I would have done a couple things different," because that seems like a very Quentin Tarantino thing to do, right? But it was the pool scene. But I will also defend the pool scene as a whole, much the same way that Blaine, you did, and then Josh, you kind of backed up. I think the pool scene works on the level that it's completely wacky, and I'm fine with that. I'm fine with the fact that like this is a bunch of kids doing something wacky because that's what teenagers would have come up with. You know, it's very, very Goonies-esque, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm fine with that aspect of it. But where I have a gripe is that the movie didn't seem to follow its own rules about its monster. And what I mean by that is, to me, what made the creature scary was that it was basically a zombie. I mean, like a magical ghost creature, invisible zombie. But the same thing that frightens us about zombies, like you can't, it never stops. It only wants like one thing.
Right.
You can't negotiate with it. You can't reason with it. It's, you know, it's not fast, but it always will come for you. Mm. That's what's scary about this. You know, like you could run away from it. But you know, like the tortoise and the hare, it's just going. And no matter how far away, it's just always going to slowly come to where you're at. And that is frightening. And I think that builds on what is on the metaphor of what we talked about in the film about kind of like your sexual past always following you. You know, it may never like be flashy But it's always there, and it's always right behind you, and it's really hard to escape it, no matter how hard you or fast you run. So now that I've done that long spiel, what, like I said, I don't think the movie follows its own rules. So once the once it is drawn into the pool, it suddenly becomes like self-aware and has intelligence and becomes like any other like weird, dreamy Freddy Krueger kind of creature. Yeah. And yeah, that just didn't work for me because like I didn't, it wasn't because I wanted their plan to work. I didn't care, like it didn't matter if it worked or not necessarily. I just wanted the creature to follow the rules that it had, because the rules that it had were what made it scary. You know, never stopping, stuff like that. So the fact that that changed in that one scene right at the end was the thing that hurt that scene for me. Not because it was wacky or, you know, this elaborate, this silly elaborate plan. Just because I didn't want the monster to change. Because if the monster can change then, why would he never change before?
Right.
So, outside of that gripe, I did think it was solid from top to bottom. And there are so many levels, and it's a very smart film. So, like, it was, outside of that, I would have very few other gripes. And now that I dump a little bit of praise on it, I will say, Blaine, what was your favorite part of this movie?
So one of the things that's really cool is how he plays with the timelessness quality. It's hard to situate this film in a particular time period,
mm-hmm,
because one of Jay's friends has that weird Kindle on a shell thing. A lot of the cars are old. They go to an old movie theater. They're wearing new clothes. You can't situate it, in any particular time period.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really neat thing, just visually, that was done. I know it bugged a lot of people. I thought it was great.
Oh, yeah, sure.
And I think that was part of what it was trying to do. But kind of in a bigger sense, and I guess this is more of a reiteration of what I said kind of at the start, but there's a quote from John Carpenter that I think is really good. It's from a film actually that's available on Netflix called Nightmares in Red, White, and Blue, The Evolution of the American Horror Film.
Mm-hmm.
It's all a documentary about horror in America. And Carpenter in there says, there are two kinds of horror movies. One is all about where evil is, the location of it. But the other says evil is in our own human hearts. That particular story is a harder one to tell. It's easy to talk about the other, but it's harder to say, I've met the enemy and he is us. And so I think this movie sort of tweaks and plays with the idea in Carpenter's quote there by saying, even when a horror film is about the it or the other thing that's out there, it's still really just about what's inside of us.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that's fascinating. And we've spent a lot of time talking about how the movie does that in various ways. So I love that.
Cool. Awesome. Great quote. Josh?
Oh man. Gosh, you know, something that I don't think I really have mentioned. Here at Real World Theology, we tend to talk a lot more about, you know, narrative and underlying theological themes and stuff like that. So, but something that I really, really enjoyed about this movie is how much, and a lot of people have mentioned this just because of how Robert David Mitchell put the movie together, is that he uses a lot of really unique perspectives to tell the story. Like that 360 camera angle that I think that you mentioned before, Blaine. And also just he's very in control the entire movie of like the aesthetic and everything like that. I read one review that compared it to Nightmare on Elm Street, and just the fact that it was very dreamy, like it's all kind of dream sequency, and the synthesizer like builds on that, just kind of how everything seems like a dream, and they're like, you know, they're always lounging around and kind of taking it easy, like when they're waiting around for the monster. You know, they're never like running around screaming unless the monster's like right there. And even then it's, you know, it's an imagined thing. So there's like this dreamy quality to it that really I think stands out and just makes it even creepier. So I think one of my, one of my favorite things of multiple different things in this movie is just the camera work and some of the angles and all the different things that they did to make it scary. It wasn't conventional, and it was really unique and interesting.
I think that would be really close to, or very similar, and probably shares a lot with what I thought was my favorite part.
Mm-hmm.
And it was the basically the atmosphere that was set through the entire movie. Just this, I think, really hard to do, or at least hard to do well, ability to capture or to create paranoia in your audience as well as in your characters.
Yeah.
And we've mentioned it all, you know, woven in all in and out of the show about like these wide shots and there being someone in the background slowly walking and we not know if they were or weren't it. And I think that Mitchell does a great job of always making us guess. I think this concept or that technique in many other people's hands would have probably been much lazier and much more easy to predict. Or it would become like a running joke, I think. And yeah. I think it worked really well. And I was honestly like in every scene, I'm like looking for someone in the background, like wondering where it is, you know? And I think that this really commendable and it lends a lot of credence to, the story, to the allegory of sorts, you know, just everything that we have enjoyed about this film. I think that kind of, that sets the tone and keeps it consistent throughout. So,
mm-hmm.
Well, with that, I want to give you guys a chance to let people know how they can get a hold of you or continue this conversation. Because, as always, we're very grateful that you guys would take time to talk about this film. I know I am. I love talking about film, and I love the fact that anyone would give up an hour or so of their time to talk about it, especially a film like this, which I think people will be talking about for quite a while. So, Blaine, if people have just enjoyed your infinite wisdom and insight and they want to talk to an adult who is not going to brush them aside, how can they follow your work on the interweb or get a hold of you?
Yeah, so you can find me on Twitter at Department of Tourism. I write reviews for you guys at Real World Theology, and then I also do some writing at Real Thinking, that's real with two E's, at WordPress.com.
Awesome. Josh, cool. How can people find you?
Well, you can find me on Twitter first at Hey, It's That Josh. You can also find me on the Facebook for Movie Lovers Letterboxd. Please go to Letterboxd, it's great. No, I do not work for them.
this promo brought to you by Letterboxd.
As has been casually observed on previous episodes of the show. But I have pretty much all the writing I do is for Real World Theology. You can find there. Got articles going every single week. Getting back into the swing of doing movie reviews after being off. I think the last review I wrote was for Shaun the Sheep. My goodness, that was a while ago.
Mm.
So I'm finally back in the saddle again with some reviews coming up. So just check out the Real World Theology website, and you can find everything that I do on the internet right there.
Awesome, awesome. And I would throw in this one last thing that I don't think we said. And I don't typically do it very often, but, you know, especially with this genre of film, to kind of break things up a little bit, is be discerning. You know, it's a movie about sex. It has some graphic things and some hard topics, so be discerning. Even though we all enjoyed it, we kind of knew what we were getting ourselves into. If you have a problem with any of us really liking this movie, like, find Josh and find Blaine where they can, or tweet me. at Fizzification on Twitter, and let us know how dumb we are for not saying that earlier. So, but as always, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast if you've enjoyed it. We really appreciate the fact that you guys took the time to listen. So, as always, I'm going to say as always, so grateful for Josh and Blaine for joining us. Please follow them on social media and around the web. Thank you so much for listening, for taking time to make us part of your week. And until next episode, remember that story is powerful and entertainment is not mindless. Bye-bye.
See ya.
So that's what happened. Like, I podcasted with somebody one time and, you know, I had to say, Josh, now that I podcasted with you, there's something coming for you. And if it catches you, it'll kill you. So you have to podcast with someone else. And then, you know, just went from there. And then we got Blaine involved. So,
unless you are in a committed relationship with another podcaster. So,
right.
But see, that's the problem, because you've noticed on this show that I'm just giving my podcasting to anybody, you know. I'm not monogamous about who I podcast with, you know. I don't have a co-host. It's I'm just like, you want a piece of this podcast? I'll give you a piece of this podcast, you know. I don't care what consequences socially, psychologically, and sometimes physically there are about podcasting with me, because I'm just giving it away. You know, no one told me when I was young that, you know, I should save my first podcast for someone special. So
I feel like this description makes me want to take a shower more than watching It Follows.
Yeah.